The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap.
In today's episode,
Me Talk students, Lieutenant Commander Colleen Wilmington and Lieutenant Commander Taylor Hudson invite Dr. Ben Reeder, NPS professor and retired commander, to discuss their most recent adventures in the Arctic and how the data collected during their time in the far north supports both their current thesis efforts and the future naval Arctic operational success.
Welcome back to the Trident Room podcast. I'm Lieutenant Commander Colleen Wilmington. If you're a returning listener, you may recognize me from the Me Talk Me Talks. If you're new, welcome to NPS. Today we're introducing a new series, The Academic Arsenal, focusing on the theses and dissertations being completed here at NPS for DoD applications. In March of this year, the Naval Postgraduate School Oceanography Department team, composed of professors from the Ocean Acoustics Lab and students from the MeTalk USW program, participated in Operation Ice Camp, or Camp Whale, to collect data to understand the physics of acoustic propagation under, through, and above the sea ice. Their research intends to lay the scientific foundation for sea ice property inference and future multimedia intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, or ISR, capabilities. The Operation Ice Camp, formerly Operation Ice Camp 2024 team, was led by Dr. Ben Reeder, research professor, commander, USN retired, John Joseph, research associate, commander retired, Taylor Hudson, student, lieutenant commander, and myself. If you want to know my background, you can listen to episode 47 for how I actually got involved. We can go around and everybody introduce themselves and how they ended up at NPS and got involved with Arctic acoustics.
I'm Lieutenant Commander Taylor Hudson. Been in the Navy for 27 years, prior enlisted, and crossed over, started off with the LDO program, and then I off-ramped to 1800. I'm here at NPS because it's part of our actual pipeline in order to promote and move on, and it's a requirement prior to our 04 milestone. So that's what brought me here to NPS. So funny story, I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do, so I know some folks can relate to that. And luckily, I talked to the program officer, and I was open and honest with her, and she said, "I can tell you what, there's somebody down the hall. Let me go see if they're here." And she walked me down the hall and introduced me to Dr. Reeder here. He explained to me about the cryophones. And once I heard how the cryophones could be operationally significant and it was more of a real world application to what the Navy needs, I was hooked. That's what got me into it.
I'm Professor Reeder. I'm retired Navy, 24 years in the Navy. Started out as a submarine officer, joined in 87 a few years ago. Did 6 years in the submarine force, and after new qualifications, transferred to MeTalk and spent most of my career focused on oceanography and ocean acoustics, and had the good fortune to go to the joint program between MIT and Woods Hole. And after getting the PhD, went out on a big deck amphib for a Gulf War II in 2003. I got my surface warfare qualifications then as well. And then after a tour as MILFAC here at NPS from 2004 to 2007, I ended my career with a 4-year tour at the Office of Naval Research managing the shallow water acoustics program for the Navy. And then after retirement in 2012, I came to NPS to join the research faculty. And over the years, I've had good fortune of getting involved in a number of different research projects. A big one is the South China Sea that ONR has funded for a good 25 years. And then the good fortune of being part of a interesting project focused on estuaries and rivers and investigated the acoustic propagation characteristics of those environments and found some interesting operational aspects to that, to those environments. But then in 2016, the Arctic Submarine Lab approached us actually here at NPS, John Joseph and myself, and invited us to participate in what was then called ICEX, now Operation Ice Camp. They go out of their way to support scientific research in the Arctic within the context of the operational exercise that they host every 2 years up in the Arctic. So in 2016, that was our first opportunity to participate. And we did some initial studies on just underwater propagation under the ice. And then since that time, we've expanded. We've discovered a few new things of interest and have expanded the research effort to focus on acoustics of the ice itself, and specifically how acoustic energy that is in the water column couples to the elastic medium of the ice sheet itself, and then even leaks into the air. In fact, Colleen and Taylor helped us collect a lot of great data just this past year in March, and we collected a ton of data both in the water column, in the ice sheet itself using the cryophones, and then in the air using a 20-meter, 8-channel microphone array that Colleen and Taylor put together for us. And so that sort of brings us to today. The research that we're pursuing in the Arctic, as Taylor suggested, it's intriguing because there's a lot of scientific questions to address in the Arctic, but it's so operationally relevant because of the importance that the Arctic is beginning to play in terms of potential threats to regional and global security as the summer recession of the ice increases, and it opens up the possibility of shipping lanes during the late summer, early fall timeframe. So the Navy is interested in the Arctic. They're concerned about the Arctic for future operations. And so we're in the process of trying to learn more about the Arctic. It's changed a lot since the Cold War and the research that occurred during the Cold War. The ice has changed. In fact, the water column has changed. If you look back in the literature published during the Cold War, the acoustic papers focused on long-range, low-frequency propagation. And that was motivated largely by the desire to track Soviet submarines during the Cold War that were notably louder than they are today. And so the researchers did fabulous work up there, but it was, again, focused and limited to long-range, low-frequency work. And what we've learned is there's a lot of finer structure in the ocean, in the water column, that contributes to very interesting features that occur in the mid-frequency range. And in fact, the ice itself hosts both low-frequency and mid-frequency acoustic propagation, and there are features there that in the ice that are of interest acoustically.
What's the frequency range for mid-frequency?
So nominally in the ocean acoustics community, low-frequency is 1,000 hertz and below, and mid-frequency is typically 1 kilohertz to 10 kilohertz. And then what we call high frequency is above 10 kilohertz. So that would include acoustic communication frequencies that are in the 20 to 30 kilohertz range. And those are torpedo frequencies as well. So that is what brings us to today in terms of how I got involved in acoustics research.
Actually, one of the things that's directly hot off the press is the new DoD Arctic strategy. And everything that Dr. Reeder just discussed actually goes to one of the sections in the Arctic strategy to address Joint Force's primary challenges in the Arctic. And that's sensing, modeling, and forecasting the environment itself, whether that's the weather, temperature, ice coverage, oceanographic conditions, and atmospheric conditions affecting the operations in the region. So we've all mentioned the cryophones, and that is an in-house sensor that was created and has been built by students and faculty here at NPS. Where did the inspiration for the cryophone come from?
The basic technology behind the cryophone is not new, actually. It consists of an accelerometer and a recorder at its base level. And essentially, it's our version of the cryophone is essentially a high-frequency version of a geophone. So seismologists use geophones around the world to monitor seismic signals, earthquakes, that sort of thing, that occur at very low frequencies, down in the tens of hertz and below. And so those instruments are also used in the Arctic during the Cold War. But again, it was limited to about 100 hertz and below. Very useful information, but it misses the higher frequencies. And there are things occurring in the water column, as well as the ice itself, that are in the frequencies above 100 hertz. So to answer your question, just reviewing the literature, the Arctic acoustics literature from the Cold War, I came across a number of papers that looked at the acoustics of the ice sheet itself. And I just recognize that they're all limited to low frequencies, and there are lots of features that occur at the higher frequencies that could be of interest. So in fact, in 2020, I literally put together my own cryophone, a geophone for the ice, on my workbench at home, and took it up to the Arctic, froze it into the ice sheet inside of a tent, and thought, well, we'll just see what we can see. And thought, well, maybe we could try to replicate as a starting point the data that were collected during the scientists in the Cold War in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. And so a couple of things happened that surprised us. One was that the cryophone records vibrations that occur in the ice. And those vibrations in the Cold War were generated by sledgehammer drops or ball drops, lead ball drops, onto the ice itself. And that impulsive forcing function generates waves in the ice. And since the ice itself is an elastic medium, as opposed to a fluid medium, it hosts not just longitudinal waves, as in the water column, but also shear waves and flexural waves. So, and these things can be picked up in the three dimensions of a three-dimensional cryofoam. So we thought we'd do some hammer drops and then see if we could replicate that data from the Cold War. Well, we didn't do it like they did it. We were running out of time. So it was the last day we were on the ice, and we said, okay, let's clear this area from 1 to 30 meters from this cryofoam. Just drop the sledgehammer, and it was a much smaller sledgehammer than they used back in the Cold War. They were using like 100-pound sledgehammers, and we had a 2-pound sledgehammer. So I went with really short ranges, and it ended up being very fortuitous because we were able to observe the response of the ice at very short ranges that they had completely ignored 40 years before. And so with these small hammer drops at short ranges, when the hammer hits the ice, it generates a compressive signal that is nearly vertically oriented. So it reflects off the bottom side of the ice and then the top side of the ice. And so it creates the standing waves. But due to the fact that the acoustic impedance contrast between the ice and the water is so small, all that energy leaks out into the water column almost immediately within tens of meters and within a fraction of a second. But those short-lived standing waves from that vertically going energy occurs at frequencies, resonant frequencies, that are correlated to how thick the ice is. And this is something that the scientists in the Cold War did not see because they were focused on low frequencies and at long ranges. They were collecting geophone signals at hundreds of meters, and we were doing it just at tens of meters. We literally stumbled across the fact that these standing waves are generated in the ice sheet, and then we could correlate the resonant frequencies to ice thickness. And another interesting thing we stumbled across was in between these hammer drops, as we stepped on the ice, we made a step to pick up the hammer to drop it the next time, even the footsteps on the ice created resonant frequencies. And so we wrote a couple of papers, one using the cryophone data to infer ice thickness just from the resonant frequencies, but then also the footsteps could be used. And then another thing we noticed was even as we walked across the ice, we could record these resonant frequencies on our iPhones in air. So this energy is leaking, the standing waves are created on the ice sheet, and then as it attenuates, as it leaks into the water column, some of it also leaks into the air sufficiently, at a level sufficient to record on an iPhone. And so we use actual iPhone recordings to infer ice thickness as well. So that, again, a total surprise, unexpected, and we were just very fortuitous to be able to discover these things. So that has led us to other things that we're trying to use the cryophones for.
Taylor, how is your thesis using the cryophones?
I wanted to build off what he just said for the layman, because Dr. Reeder is...
There's a lot of words.
Dr. Reeder is probably one of the smartest people I've ever met. But for those that are listening, what's been amazing about going back and looking at the data, especially from the earlier exercises and research collection, was you picked up the ball drops, you picked up the hammer drops, you picked up the steps. But what I found amazing was, as you all were walking, these cryophones actually picked up your conversations. So I found that fascinating because you think, you know, you're thinking of a microphone or something like that. This is not a microphone. This thing is coupled to the ice and it still picked up the conversation to the point where you could recognize who was talking, what they were saying. And this thing is on the ice and they're walking above it. And it also picked up the aircraft that were flying overhead that were delivering supplies.
To the point you could identify what type of aircraft it was.
Just about, yeah. And so, like I said before, this has been one of the things, you know, when we're talking about the Arctic, it's mainly been sub-on-sub kind of problem for anti-submarine warfare. And this is a tool that can bring other platforms back into the fight. And that's what amazes me about all of this. And that's what gets me excited. Now, what was your question?
How does your thesis use the cryophone data?
My thesis is going to be built on the actual active coherent source EMAT. We launched a couple of those and looking at the EMAT data.
And an EMAT is an...
That's an expendable mobile anti-submarine training target. It's like a little fish that emits a sound. And so it's pre-programmed. And
it's like a mini torpedo.
Yeah, it really does. We dropped a couple of those. And so looking at that data and being able to do match filtering and being able to pick up the different propagation paths associated with those, and eventually, hopefully, based off the number of sensors that able to analyze, be able to localize and maybe get into depth determination, but at a minimum, be able to at least recognize the propagation paths, the distances, and localization from the cryophone on a coherent source.
My thesis is also using cryophone data, but I'm trying to look more at the actual ice properties, such as the depth, the thickness of the ice, the density, the flexural strength, and then working to tie that into a model that's actually hosted here at NPS, the Regional Arctic System Model, which provides a 6-month outlook on the ice thickness and concentration, and determining whether or not we can accurately forecast the thickness of the ice in support of naval operations in the Arctic. Operation Ice Camp, Taylor, you mentioned, is primarily for submarine testing and training. So it really is kind of an honor to be invited up, especially among other universities such as MIT, University of Alaska Fairbanks, but also working with other agencies such as the Army Cold Regions Research and Engineering Laboratory, or CREL, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, and even foreign agencies such as the Norwegian Defense Research Establishment, FFI, and then alongside our normal research entities for the Navy, ONR and NRL. So how have, Taylor, I know this was your first exercise, but how have you seen the operation evolve to support those operational standards, specifically from the NPS standpoint? And is there any difficulties that we've had to overcome, such as correlating the data because it's not being detected in the same area, or because the ice is different, maybe it's first-year ice, maybe it's multi-year ice? What are some of the things that you've seen?
Well, in terms of how the operation ice camp has changed over the years. I know back in the Cold War, leading up to the, let's say, 10 to 15 years ago, the ice camps were in place longer and they used a lot of heavier construction. They actually built plywood structures and had a lot more infrastructure up there. But since 2014, the emphasis has been on being small and agile. And so now the camp consists of tents. And even these tents are Arctic tents, but the Arctic Submarine Lab has tested a number of new ideas to make them as small and agile and flexible as possible. So one example is they put these tents on tarps, heavy tarps, that have tow bars, and they have these track machines.
Snowmobiles
and other track machines that can actually pull a tent away from, say, maybe a lead that opens up in the ice. They've developed these different machines. They have snow blowers on these tracked machines. And they've become very efficient and very adaptable to the differing conditions. So that's one way that the camp itself has changed over the years. And ASL could give many more examples of that. In terms of the science, John Joseph and I, in our work, typically are part of the science teams that go up right as the camp gets put in place before any kind of assets enter the area. And so we typically do our science in the first week of the camp. And so that has been generally our approach. We're up there during the beginning of the camp and just for a 5 or 6 day period. Although one thing we would like to investigate is leaving some of our equipment in place over the period of the entire 5 to 6 weeks the camp is in place. We can gather more data over longer periods of time. And we're trying to work on the cryophone to develop to a point where it can actually be left and can have sufficient power and memory to be deployed for 6 weeks. So those are some of the ways that they've changed and the ways we've approached it. ASL has, in the last few years, invited more science teams up to the camp, both before, during, and after the end of the camp, before, during, and after assets are in the vicinity of the camp. So ASL has been really supportive, a good bunch of people that are motivated and enthusiastic about what the work they do and the work we're doing. They're very helpful. Anytime there's a problem or a complication, they're right there ready to help to make the work happen. So even though the science is not near the top of the priority list, they really work hard to make it happen. And so we've been beneficiaries of that.
I'd have to echo that. Even though it was my first time up on the ice in this situation, working with ASL, I thought that was probably one of the most professional group of individuals that I'd ever seen. And the fact that the majority of that equipment that we used, as far as like the Arctic gear we were wearing that were issued to the science teams, the tents, a lot of the equipment was all refurbished coming from DRMO. And ASL has gone out and collected all that gear, checked it out, tested it, and made sure it's going to be useful in that environment. But the fact that they didn't get a significant amount of funding, we talked about the Navy is invested in the Arctic, but we don't see that translate into requirements, which drives funding for other agencies to build and develop, whether it be, you know, new technology or models or anything of that sort. So the Navy is still lacking on requirements that feed that acquisition beast, but the ASL team, hands down, they were top tier.
And just to add to the understanding in terms of logistics required for the ice camp, and the ice camp is deployed and built on a floating ice floe 200 nautical miles north of the coast. All right, so the camp is built on ice that's anywhere from a meter to 2 meters thick on top of 12,000 feet of water, right? So the choice of the ice flow is a very careful, deliberate choice that consists of both, and you can speak to this more, Colleen, based on your experience at the Ice Center, but it has to be a certain type of ice flow that has both first-year ice that supports the airstrip, but multiple-year ice for the camp to be built on for safety. So that choice is very deliberate. And then the logistics for the camp itself, flying all that equipment up and all the things that are needed, not just the science, but just to live up there for a few weeks. And then everything has to be brought back. All right. And I'm sure you can add to that.
Yeah. And like I said earlier, a lot of that we actually went through in episode 47. But the first year ice is smoother, so it's easier for the aircraft to land on. And the multi-year ice is thicker and we want to live on it. And the burning question is, how thick was the ice that we lived on and the ice that we worked on this past March?
To comment on the choice of ice flow and how, and the question of how thick it is, and that's one question that our cryophone hopefully we'll be able to contribute to in the future. So our current version, that's like generation 3, where essentially it's all internally powered and recording, but we're in the process of now trying to develop onboard processing that would support satellite communications so that we could deploy these things in the ice for long periods of time with sufficient power, but with communication capabilities so that we can actually monitor the ice remotely with the cryophones that would be passing information back that could be used to infer ice thickness over the period of the season, from thin ice that's too thin to sufficiently thick ice, and then again during melt. That's one question, one need, one operationally relevant question that the cryophone should be able to answer.
And I just wanted to backtrack a little bit. For those not familiar, ASL is the Arctic Submarine Lab, which is a component of the Undersea Warfighting Development Center. And Taylor, you mentioned, you know, the funding in support of all of this. And Dr. Rader, you mentioned all of the logistics and getting everybody out. But it's not just the submarines transiting under the ice. It's not just the airplanes bringing ASL or the scientists up. There's also a lot of VIPs that go up to observe this operation and work on linking what is being done at camp back to strategies and funding. And I know this year we actually got to briefly talk with the Secretary of the Navy, Honorable Carlos Del Toro, and Senator Mark Kelly, who are both NPS alumni. These VIP attendees represent a tie between continuing operations and strategic developments. And how does NPS strive to connect with those strategies and use those as research support? That was a very long question, I know.
So the question is, how do we connect to the strategies?
I was going to say, connecting to the strategies, that plays more to CTG 80.7, because CTG 80.7 puts the money for the METOC program as far as the naval officers here, and they suggest that, but CTG 80.7, correct me if I'm wrong, doesn't control the faculty. The faculty, that is a different line of money, and so they've got to figure out what other kind of research they want to do.
Right. It is connected, but it's not tightly connected, right? So there's different colors of money, different pots of money in the Navy. All of my research dollars come from funding agencies like the Office of Naval Research, who are tasked with funding and directing research that is operationally relevant, that is of interest to the Navy. All right, so the Arctic and the potential threats in the future are certainly considerations, and ONR funds the Arctic research that they feel would contribute to answering questions that would support future naval capabilities in the Arctic. But within that, there's a lot of flexibility and there's a lot of latitude. And so in my work, I've submitted proposals to ONR that are like this cryophone work that I see on potentially answering operationally relevant questions, but yet it's science. So it has to address very specific, substantial scientific questions. And fortunately, both those things go hand in hand in this case, where the acoustic propagation in the water column in this new environment that we see that's different than the Cold War and we can talk more about that in a minute, as well as the changes in the ice, all those things have significant science questions involved that if we can answer those questions, if we can understand the acoustic propagation through these media better and then be able to model that, then that can go into answering other Navy needs. So the Arctic strategies are kind of big picture sorts of documents, but then from the science end of it, we have to answer specific science questions that will lend itself to an answer, contribute to the answer.
And what I was kind of getting at was looking at the future students that are coming to MPS, you know, some have an idea of what they kind of want to get into, whether it be meteorology or oceanography. You get the choice when you come here, which path you want to take, but there's no real bank of questions from CTG 80.7 as far as what are some issues that our officers and our teams are actually seeing out in the fleet that could be turned into what are some questions they want answered that could be fed back to MPS as far as the program here for officers to sift through and go, yes, I want to see if I can answer that question. Because once the students show up, then it becomes kind of like this, they're shopping, basically, you know, they're talking to some of the faculty going, you know, what kind of research are you doing? And are they interested? Do they want to work with this faculty member or not? And then there's, you know, there's periods where the faculty actually present their research to try to persuade students to come and help them in the research. But there would be a nice tie-in from actual fleet questions or problems that they're having that we could use the time here to research and answer those questions potentially and tie it all back to actual current strategies, you know, from the strategic standpoint.
And I know I was one of those lucky few that I came in knowing that I wanted to focus on the Arctic, reached out to the RASM coordinators, Dr. Wieslaw Maslowski, and then got involved with the acoustics and found a way to link them together because that was an issue that I saw when I was at the Naval Ice Center. And looking at who's in those presentations from the professors were exactly how I got coordinated with, okay, who else is looking at these projects and how can I coordinate this?
I mean, if I could make one comment. From the student perspective, the process is informally connected, right? Between the science that's occurring and these strategic documents, there's no one formal process or mechanism that's been established to feed questions or challenges from the fleet to scientists specifically, although that does happen on an informal basis. So we have a couple of retired admirals on campus here that are the USW chairs for USW and mining, and part of their work is to make those connections. So that does happen in a variety of ways. But in terms of like a formal scientific requirements process, I don't know that it exists. It's more informally driven. With my operational background, it's like I'm always looking for the operationally relevant science questions because I work for the Navy. My ocean acoustics is very Navy-centric, very submarine sonar-centric. So I try to make those connections myself. And I think a lot of researchers, particularly at MPS, try to do that as well.
And I wanted to also tag on, Taylor, you mentioned the METOC students who come in. We have the two fairly set paths that it's either meteorology or oceanography. But even in that, we can support the operations research department. We can get our space system certificate. We can get an anti-submarine warfare certificate and link our research from the environment level across other departments here at NPS. So if you are listening and this Arctic research interests you and you're not necessarily a METOC, you can still get involved with some of the projects that are going on and lend your expertise or your fleet experience back. And just wanted to say thank you to both of you for lending your time to this podcast. Are there other projects coming up that students may want to get involved in, whether it's Arctic or in your wheelhouse, that are coming available?
We anticipate that our Arctic research program will continue into the foreseeable future. Of course, all dependent on funding. But I've got a solid page of science questions that will keep us busy for at least 10 years. So there's lots of work to be done up there. My other large project, science project, is in the South China Sea. Again, very operationally relevant region. It's a little bit more difficult to get students involved in that in terms of data collection, but certainly I've got lots of data that can be analyzed from various field experiments and more coming up next year as well. And then a lot of modeling. Anytime we have data sets, we want to analyze the data and then run models to help us understand and interpret the data. In fact, both of you are doing that very thing with the Arctic data.
So much fun.
Your favorite thing. So that's just two projects I'm involved in, but there's many projects even within the Oceanography Department that provide a lot of opportunity for students to invest in.
Sincere thanks to the Arctic Submarine Lab for letting us go up and do some of this research.
Couldn't do it without them.
To NPS for supporting that travel and research collection. Thank you all for listening to the Trident Room podcast, Academic Arsenal.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at TridentRoomPodcastHost@nps.edu.